I wanted to share some of the Book of Mormon material which I'm engaged in and which research now by many others is being compiled and should be of interest to you, particularly since that is the emphasis for this year and the coming year. I think we can start right off by going to the Book of Mormon itself and let it stimulate some of the areas of interest. We already have confirmed under chapter 10 of 1 Nephi, where it says, "And it came to pass after my father had spoken these words, he spake unto my brethren concerning the gospel which should be preached among the Jews, and also concerning the dwindling of the Jews in unbelief." And that gospel that we have today as a restoration, I think we've given you at least an idea that most of the evidences of organization and practice and doctrine had been had 200 years before Christ at least, and right up until the first and part of the middle of the second century. And then many of those doctrines had been preserved by Jewish groups as well, Christian groups, and finally even Chinese and distant other areas, to the extent that they preserved teachings, unique and otherwise. So we know that the gospel in its entirety had been had at some time. Then with the dwindling of the Jews in unbelief after the second and third century, many of these teachings were finally embraced by at least 34 different groups in the fourth century who finally distorted, perverted, and surrounded these teachings with a great deal of bizarre material. And that should be emphasized. In the reading of these ancient texts, you'll find there is much there that's reprehensible and certainly not acceptable in terms of the doctrine, but by the fourth century, it was unique they even retained anything. And when people go through, they try to analyze the strata or the levels, and the material has been added during the ages until you get back into the central, eternal, original things. And that's the challenge of the specialists who work on the area. Now, there's exciting things going on where the Book of Mormon is concerned, where Israel is concerned, and discoveries are being made. I have a handout here that was passed out earlier, and there are 47 discoveries concerning the Book of Mormon. We'll only refer to several of these, and then there's other brand new ones that I'll be mentioning, and some of them you can surely get sometime this year because they're available in print. And because some of these books are very large, I want to get them off the top here as soon as possible. So one of these is called the Monuments of Civilization on the Maya. Contained in here are some rather pertinent statements concerning the brothers. In the Book of Mormon, most of you should be at least now by at the end of 2 Nephi or getting close to it. But in the first part, it described the brothers and their migrations and the activities concerning the Lehi coming over. Now see if you find any parallels here. When we arrived at the shore of the sea, there all the tribes and the warriors were reunited at the shore of the sea. And when they looked upon it, their hearts were heavy. There's no way to cross it. We know of no one who's crossed the sea, the warriors and the seven tribes said to each other. And then someone facetiously says, "Who is a log on which we can cross it, our brother?" You know, they come down to the seashore and say, "Now, how are you going to cross that thing? Who's got a log that can cross that one?" "We trust only in you," they said. And we spoke to them in this manner, go first carefully. How can we cross in truth, we who are here? Thus we all said, "Have pity on us, O brother. If we remain here to sleep, we shall be conquered. We, the two eldest sons, the chiefs and the heads, the first warriors of the seven tribes, O our brother, would that we could cross and see without delay the gifts which our mothers and our fathers have given to us, O my brother." Thus they talked with each other. "We have not come here to stay huddled at the shore of the sea without being able to look upon our country, which we were told we should see. You are warriors, our seven tribes." And so the younger brother says, "Let us plunge into the sea immediately." When we arrived at the gates of Tulan, which in Mayan means bountiful, we received a red stick, which was our staff. Thus we passed over the rows of sand, when it widened below the sea and on the surface of the sea. Immediately all were rejoiced when they saw the sands or the beach below the sea. Thereupon they held counsel. "Here is our hope. There on the first land we must be reunited. Only there can we be organized now that we have arrived from Tulan." And in here, Tulan again means bountiful. They set sail from a place called Bountiful, and they arrived at a place they called Bountiful. There were at least seven tribes or seven groups. There were two eldest sons who were berating their younger brother. And you can easily see the parallels there to the 10th chapter of Mosiah, 7th chapter of 1 Nephi, and so forth. These are from the annals of the Kakakelis, the Indians of the Guatemala Highlands. And that book is available now. It's even in paperback, and so you want to probably try to obtain that. A little bit of discussion, perhaps, of books themselves might be of interest to you. In the books of Shalom Balaam, this is the history of the world in those times, because it has been written down, because the time has not yet ended for making these books, these many explanations, so that Maya men may be asked if they know how they were born here in this country when the land was founded, and the knowledge of the true God, the Lord of heaven and earth, our Lord God. Very rightly, they were worshipped as true gods. Now, here again is a record that ancient records were held, that a book was held. Now, the book of Shalom Balaam, and maybe I can tell you a little interesting story tonight. When Brother Ullman was bringing me in, we were talking about the destinies of men and how timing brings children into the world. And I have a little boy. We had tried many years to have another child, and my wife had finally given up. And I'd taken her with me on an expedition to Yucatan. I had been there often. I did a lot of work in Central America. My profession is an explorer. I'm an exploration geologist, and we do a lot of archaeology in conjunction with our work. And we'd gone into the northern area of Yucatan. I had taken two Mayans with me, because when you go into zones of archaeology, you have to have someone who represents the government. And there were two Mayan men were with me, and my wife got tired in one of the ruins. She sat down in the lap of a Chacmol god. And one of them turned to the other and said that... She better not do that, she'd get pregnant. My wife couldn't understand them, of course. I had barely understood them. And then the other one turned to him and made a surprising statement. You're not Shalom Balaam. And that was the first I realized that the Mayans today are still believing in Shalom Balaam. He's the one that told them that their lands would be restored to them and there would be a church and an organization. Now remember this. The Mayans were not conquered by the conquistadores. The Aztecs were. When Cortez entered into the central Mexican area, the Aztecs themselves were overcome by the conquistadores about 1519-1523. 23 years later, when one of the Spanish individuals, I think his name is Montoya, was sent over to be governor of the Mayans, they had already gone underground. They just vanished into the jungle. Their books were not destroyed when Bishop Dalanda burned the Aztec books. Most of the Mayan texts and everything were hid up in caves or wherever they possibly could. A missionary who just returned from Guatemala, by the name of Webster, who I know personally lives in my ward now, and we're working out another expedition to go back, had been taken by one of the Kakakeli Indians, and they're working very much there. The branch president of the Guatemalan area that was destroyed by the earthquake recently was a Chacakeli Indian. And he had been taken by one of the priests into an area, and he was shown three codices. And this particular priest told him that this was just representative of many of the books that had been retained, and they had been standing guard for all these years over those ancient books. And they knew sooner or later they'd be made available. And because of the interesting parallels, the Book of Mormon, the priest was inclined to give him this additional information. He could recognize some of the hieroglyphs as being those familiar to books he was familiar with of the two books. But the third book, which was big as a telephone book, looked like the Anton transcript type of writing. Now, he wasn't permitted to do any more than take a look at those, and then they took him to some ruins in the northern part of Guatemala that Indians have not been yet found. These three things maybe should be pertinent for your understanding. There are 12,000 ruins in Mexico. Only 200 have been excavated. So we don't know very much yet about what went on, historically or otherwise. Number two, we were talking just about Mexico, between British Honduras and Guatemala and San Salvador, Costa Rica, and on down to the peninsula of Panama and on into South America. Most of those territories are essentially still unexplored. There are many ruins. Some of the largest of all and the longest causeway appeared in the National Geographic about a year ago this month. Some of you knew that. They found it by air, but no one's been on the ground yet to follow through. It'll take years, perhaps, to excavate it. But as they begin to excavate, here are some of the things they're finding. A professor back east, Dr. Coe, who's not a Mormon, but now he knows we're using his book at these kind of lectures, and that disturbs him a little bit. He was invited to come to BYU a year or two ago, and he gave a talk. And interestingly enough, some of the experts that he quotes, one of them was a companion of mine on 21 expeditions 20 years ago, Dr. Gareth Lowe, who last month began to write some of the things he's learned in all these years. It's taken him 20 years to establish himself as an expert in certain areas of Mexico, from the Olmec area, Campeche, Chiapas, and that area. Now he's referred to by the experts. Now he'll start dealing with our point of view, I'm quite sure, in due time. The America's first civilization, discovering the Olmec. Dr. Coe talks about a civilization that sprang without any predecessor, all at once, immediately, with grandeur and all kinds of architectural and organizational means. Approximately between 1800 and 2200 B.C., and then destroyed itself by internecine wars between 300 and 600 B.C. Any similarity to anything you know? Very much so. Very close to the very Jaredite situation we talk about. Geographically, it's in the right area. The time span is the same thing. And that Dumbarton Oaks, they had a symposium on just exactly what happened to these people. And their conclusion was they were fighting in the family. They were killing each other off. And that's exactly what the Book of Ether describes in terms of internecine, interfamily fighting. Well, America's first civilization now is called the Olmec. On Tuesday, I received this book, Olmec Religion. I haven't finished reading it yet, but already here's what some of the things are being mentioned. Around the year 2000 B.C., a significant phenomena occurred, and all the architectural orientation of the communities of this particular group were oriented 8 degrees west or true north. At midnight at the summer solstice, the setting zenith, and there's a whole book on the astroastronomy associated with these ancient ruins, touches the northern horizon, and the structures and the buildings and everything were so oriented. And then this particular writer goes on and says, and then the moment in time marking the final stage of construction is between 300 and 400 B.C. And that's when things wound up where the Olmecs were concerned, or the Jaredites, in the Book of Mormon. Then that's as far as I've got, so I still haven't got yet to the discussion of the religion. And I'm going to see if there's any parallel to the Book of Ether when I get that far. That's how fast books are occurring and being brought to our attention. Now let's go back here to this big one I've got on my lap up here and talk about some things that's happened here recently. Before 1950, very little of the things we're talking about were available in English translation. Some of the things you should be familiar with now is the book The Popol Vuh. And these are available today in stores. The Popol Vuh is called the Sacred Book of the Ancient Kichamaya. It was written because in their stories, the ancient records had been lost. And so now they're trying to rewrite their record. And the Popol Vuh means the people's book. In the very first part of this, I have time to give you the details, but it talks about the creation, the expanse of heaven. And some of the last words go like this. And thus was the earth created when it was formed by the heart of heaven, the heart of earth, as they are called, who first made it fruitful, and so it was made perfect the work when they did it after thinking and meditating about it. Now, the three individuals involved in the creation here is the creator, or the maker, and then Gucumatz, Tepu, and Gucumatz is the forefather, and Tepu would be equivalent to Jesus Christ. And therefore, the main participants were the Father, the Son, and Michael, or the forefather. Adam. They were surrounded with light. Now the parallel is interesting. If you get the Popol Vuh, since it's available, you can read this, and it's out of sequence to the Book of Genesis, not a sequence to the Book of Moses, but it's in sequence to the temple endowment in terms of creation. Where did they get it? And the back part of this also talks about the heart of heaven blew mist in their eyes, which clouded their sight, as when a mirror is breathed upon. Their eyes were covered so they could only see what was close, only that was clear to them. The doctrine of forgetfulness of those born here upon the earth was developed in this particular book. Now, there's many other parallels, but those are some very essential ones. And then the annals of the Kakakelis in Guatemala and the Lords of Tuanacapan. That book has a great deal of interest to Latter-day Saints. For example, this is the one that talks about the four families who arrived at Bountiful from a place called Bountiful or Toulon. From the west we came to Toulon, from across the sea. And it was at Toulon where we arrived to be engendered and brought forth by our mothers and our fathers. And then the individual writing this says, so they told us. So there had been a history of this group coming down through. When we arrived at the shore of the sea, there all the tribe and the warriors were united at the shore of the sea. And then I read that party to you, especially concerning the brothers and about their coming over and across. And then it talks about the description of the first five cities, which a person can study and parallel those that were described in the Book of Mormon and Nephi. Also here is the Gilgal, which is a compass. The Giron Gagal, also mentioned here. It's a symbol of power and majesty, a carefully kept stone or compass, related further on, made the other people fear and respect them. It's also mentioned in the Popol Vuh. And you can find that in your Book of Mormon as well. Now, the Popol Vuh It was written in 1554 and not into English until 1951. Joseph Smith couldn't have had it available. The Annals of the Kakakili Indians was translated in English for the first time in 1953. It was produced in Guatemala also during the 16th century. And the titles of the Lords of Tuanacapan were produced in 1554 also and not made available in English until 1953. And then there's what they call the Chronicles of each little Chochitl. He was a royal Aztec in the year 1568. And you can remember the name. It's a little Chochitl. No, it's a little Chochitl. Is that close enough? ¿Cómo se dice en español? It's a little Chochitl.
No, please,
okay, I'm close enough. So, it's a little Chochitl was a royal Aztec. He wrote the history of his people, and he talks about the three migrations of the three different individuals in the first group being very large stature people, how they came over in boats, and some of them in a rather tomb-like boat. There was a series of migrations, and parallels chronologically much of the Book of Mormon. In fact, it was not translated in English until 1950, and then it was translated at the request of Milton R. Hunter, and was included in a book on America before Columbus. It's called Archaeology and the Book of Mormon. And so much of the chronicles of the East Little Chochitl are found in that book by Milton R. Hunter. And you can get it made available there because it parallels so much that he's got parallels from East Little Chochitl on one side and the Book of Mormon on the other. And yet most people hadn't even read it. But it's being revived, a number of these great discoveries, because they're very pertinent and very important. But some things began to happen here a decade or so ago. They found in Dresden, Germany, that had been there since 1739, a book called now the Dresden Codex, which deals with Mayan calendars and chronology. And then they found in Madrid, likewise, which is now called the Madrid Codex, 8 yards long, 24 feet long, 112 pages of material. And then they found in Paris, also now called the Paris Codex, another book, 5 feet long, with 22 pages. Now these materials are now being prepared. These are copies of it here in this particular text. No one can really read it, but two different individuals, one at Stanford and another individual left from Mexico just recently, believe that they're getting close now to getting some of these things broken. Then the Pope of Vu we mentioned to you, and several others, and then the Shalom Balam. I'll go back to my story. It's only about Yucatan. I didn't know that they knew about Shalom Balam, and I've been hunting for the book of Shalom Balam, and I was to find it when I, what I consider rather miraculous manner, later date. Time doesn't permit us the story. But sure enough, a year later, I had a little baby boy. And so I recommend trips to Yucatan. If you'd like to go. These books, then, as they become made available, will be of interest to everyone because of the parallels. And, of course, Joseph Smith stated on page 25 of the Book of Mormon, he said, Nephi, your people are going to prepare books and they're going to be hidden away and they will come forth in the due time of the Lord. And so we can expect here pretty soon great discoveries to be made in Mesoamerica and elsewhere concerning the Book of Mormon. Now let's go back to the Olmecs. Sure, just because the chronology is there, that parallel alone doesn't really substantiate an awful lot. And we might sometimes in our eagerness to find parallels, and I'm probably guilty of it more than anyone, try to see certain things that may have or may not have parallels to Mormon doctrine. But now we get to some specifics and see what you think. It's in the Book of Ether, Chapter 2, where it refers to the Jaredites bringing over Deseret, the royal bee. Now, here's what Burnell says in his book. The Olmec world, the royal bee, was probably kept for its honey. Even today, the Papaluka Indians who live in the ancient Olmec area practice a number of rites connected with the keeping of this insect, indicating its ancient origins. Now, that's getting rather interesting. Why would Joseph Smith have selected the royal bee to mention concerning the Jaredites? Now, there's many other things. There's a whole book on the subject, and I'm just mentioning one or two as we go along, just to expose you to the possibilities, you see, where the Book of Mormon is concerned. Now, there's another one. Some of you may be familiar with this book, He Walked the Americas. You've seen this? Some of you know L. Taylor Hansen. She's a woman now, quite elderly in Phoenix. She had included in her book, according to her own story, as reported to me, a number of panels, which she knew very well, their origins and meaning and significance, at least to her understanding. But on page 56, she had inserted a panel she didn't know really why, but she was compelled to include it. And let me describe this panel, because after she gave a lecture on this, a Mormon went up to her and asked her to read a Book of Mormon and pointed out a passage in it. In this panel, it shows a young man with a turban on his head and a rather interesting Mesopotamian-type garment reaching into a sack and pulling out 16 stones. He turns around and puts the stones on an altar, and a hand comes out and touches the stones, and suddenly in the next panel, he's face to face with a young god. Any parallels you know about? She joined the church. Because now she knew why she had inserted that panel. It's quite specific. Nothing more direct could be come out of that area. Now, a book that most of you can get is called Burning Water, The Thought and Religion in Ancient Mexico, republished last May by Loretta Chajerny. She's a French archaeologist living in Mexico. She's done a powerful study here of the thought and religion, and I have enough material here to talk for 7 hours in her book, and to follow through, I'm only going to touch upon some highlights, because this book you can get. But just to show you some of the things, here's my tabs. It talks about such things as dreams, fast offerings, the Lord, the chosen people, the oaths, the libraries, the Lord, the work of the dead, and then, that's a very good one. The heavenly origins of man. It is significant that the demons who decide, because of Quetzalcoatl's irritating purity, to cause his downfall. Could that have been Lucifer's problem? Oh, thou were made in the place where are the great God and goddess. See, it talks about Mother in Heaven too. Which are above the heavens. Thy mother and thy father, celestial woman and celestial man, made and reared thee. Thou hast come to this world from afar, poor and weary. Our Lord Quetzalcoatl, who is the creator, has put into this dust a precious stone and a rich feather. Can you imagine that coming out of Mesoamerican material today? Just like I quoted out of the Nag Hammadi, or the gospel, according to Joseph Smith, has restored it. Well, those are the kind of things that are in here. And here's another one. Quetzalcoatl did penance, piercing his legs and drawing blood, with which he stained and made bloody the Magi spikes. The Magi. And this custom and order the priests and ministers of the Mexican idols took over, as Quetzalcoatl had used. So this retentive knowledge concerning the piercing of the legs and the blood of this ancient god. Now the god they're referring to here is the one, of course, that's called the white god of the Mesoamerican area. And then here's another one, paralleling Lehi's vision. Among others, there is a vast river on the road leading to liberation. Instead of crossing alone, Quetzalcoatl builds a bridge so that his disciples can follow him. This bridge building speaks once again of his mission to establish communication between earth and God, to unite man with God. Another place where they said the souls of the dead went, the earthly paradise. And then there's some interesting parallels here concerning where the souls of the dead go. The human existence was thought of as a preparation for death, which represented true birth, and they said that they did not die, but awoke from a dream they had lived, and become once more spirits or gods. They said, too, that some were transformed into the sun, others into the moon, and others into planets. This is coming out of Mesoamerica. You see, very, very specific. You can't get away from it. And the initiation determines the soul's destiny was not accessible to all. The 3 degrees of glory here. Then the gods took counsel and said, who shall dwell here? He came to the kingdom of the dead. Talks about many of the fascinating areas. Well, anyway, you can see what we're doing here. The spirit birth is here. Knowledge, the council in heaven is even mentioned. And speaks about it just like was there. The universal salvation. Parallels to the Olmecs again. The father is mentioned. The ancient god, or the father of all the gods, who is the god of fire. This is where they get the burning water doctrine from. Then there's the battle in heaven too, ritual initiation, which once represented the sacred battle between heaven and earth. It refers to it, and the souls are referred to, the symbols of struggle that allows the body to blossom into a soul. Because he belongs equally to the dark abyss and the celestial spender, man is the meeting ground of opposing principles. Remember what Lehi said? And again, it talks about the three worlds. Evidently, we are in the presence of a scene of initiation into the spirit world. The only one that allows communication among the three worlds. There's a description here in one of the documents that I have all the notations on. You can't see it from there, which shows the descent of man back down and then his ascent back up and through all the vicissitudes of which he has. And I have parallels to 3rd Nephi, 1st Nephi, 11, and a whole series of things in terms of what is found in the book by Sojourning. It's a very valuable one that confirms so much of Mormon teachings and doctrine, and it's amazing that this material is laid so long unexamined by students of ancient religion. And now the material is becoming available. She knows nothing about Mormons. And that's what Joseph Smith said, the Gentiles will find the books, and they'll restore them to us. Now there's some others here. We go to one that's kind of interesting. It has to do with saints. Joseph Smith could have, in the Book of Mormon, on page 68, in verse 18, says, "Behold the righteous, the saints of the Holy One of Israel." Prior to the Christian church, did they actually call the ancient people saints? And then the Dead Sea Scrolls, what did they call them there? What did the people of Qumran call themselves? In a brand new book just received here recently called Post-Biblical Jewish Studies, Dr. Vermish, one of the archaeologists who excavated the ruins and translated most of the documents and helped with them, he now says this. Both content, talking to Philo and Josephus, and connecting the people of Qumran with the Essenes, neither of them simply declare that they called themselves saints. In another place here, he says they were called saints, servants of God, because more than anyone else, they offered to God the only true worship, their own healing. Theirs was a search for and the acquisition of moral perfection and the result of the sanctification of the mind. And they were in every way particular servants of God. They consider it worthier to sanctify their minds than to offer sacrifice. They offered to God truly spiritual worship. Therefore, the original name of this group, he gives an interesting parallel here, they were healers, worshipers and healers. They were saints. So that gives Joseph Smith confirmation that in the ancient days before the time of Christians, they actually called certain groups the saints. Now, in chapter 9, on page 66 of the Book of Mormon, verse 2, "And I spent two whole Sundays teaching this particular chapter because of so many new parallels that confirm the Book of Mormon, just that chapter alone. I only want to bring your attention to one. It says, the Jews will be restored to the true church and the fold of God. Now, who would have the audacity in 1829 to say that the Jews will eventually be taught the gospel that Joseph Smith was going to restore? Now, do you know what's happening in Israel? Do any of you know what's happening there? Some of you do. I just want to give you a quick summary of some things that are happening, because it'll be of interest to you, I'm sure. After 1841, when Orson Hyde was to dedicate the land for the return of the Jews, some interesting things had happened that were to be disastrous to the Jews, and some other things had happened which were to be complementary as well. How many of you know why Hitler incinerated so many of the Jewish group? Do any of you know why? When I was in Israel, I found a book that had been published by the Jews themselves. Here's something that might interest you. In 1819, just a year before the dispensation would be opened up and the favor of God restored to the Jews and their land dedicated for their return, the German Jews issued what they called the Hamburg Proclamation, the Hamburg Reform Society, in which they deleted and altered the traditional prayers calling for the ingathering of the exiles in Israel. Can you imagine what the adversary was doing here? At the very moment, after 1,900 years, when the Jews were to be restored fruitfully and given all the things promised them in all those decades and centuries, here the German Jews issued a proclamation saying, no more, we're not going back to Israel. Some later Reformed prayer books went further and eliminated from the ritual even such seemingly innocuous phrases as the remembrance of Jerusalem. And then the Pittsburgh platform was expressed in 1885 by the Polish Jews. They expressed the Reformed position. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state. 2 years before that, another member of the First Presidency had gone back to Israel to reaffirm the dedication. Now, in the Holocaust, these two original groups combined together to form what they call the anti-Zionist movement. Already, there had been aliyahs, the aliyah, the return of the Jews, beginning with the Russians, back in about the 50s. And by 1897, at the great meeting that was held in Basel, Switzerland, the Jews knew well that they were impelled and things were going to occur to benefit them.
And by the time Hitler had rose to power in 1933, this group, who had absorbed the Hamburg and the Pittsburgh platforms, were now subject of the activity of the Hitler regime. And in fact, 3 million of the Polish Jews who subscribed to the Pittsburgh platform were killed by Hitler, and 1 million of the German Jews who subscribed to the Hamburg Reform were killed by Hitler. In fact, you see, they had said, "We're not going back to Jerusalem. We're not going to rebuild the temple. We're no longer God's people. We're just a religious community." It'd be the same thing if you wrote a letter to the president of the church today and say, "We're not going back to Jackson County, Missouri. We're not going to build a temple in Jackson County, Missouri." It'd go over big, wouldn't it? And so the Jews understand that the Holocaust, which cost them 1/3 of their total world population, was in part a result of the fact that in despair, 1900 years later from their dispersion, at the moment they were to be restored to their Palestine glory and to their land to build their temple, that a group of people said, "We're not going back," and they didn't. There was a young man at the turn of the century who had heard many of the church authorities when they returned from Jerusalem talking about the return. And finally in his heart he said, "I will know this church is true and prophecy is relevant if the Jews ever return." And then some events began to transpire. I'll give you a real quick summary here. It might be of interest to you. In 1873, the first great agricultural... And remember, this is the Book of Mormon doctrine. It said the Jews were going to be restored. They're going to go back to their land. And in the 124th section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it says a temple will be built in New Jerusalem, and a temple will be built in Old Jerusalem, where work for the dead will be done. You want to read those sections because they're rather pertinent. And that temple in Old Jerusalem has yet to be built, and work for the dead will be done there. By whom? Only those, of course, who have the priesthood. Who? Among the Jews and the Arabs, because they're both going to be together in that respect. Then in 1897, Basel, Switzerland, under Herzl, then the great Zionist Congress was held, and by 1914, 90,000 Jews had returned. When Orson Hyde dedicated the land for the return of the Jews, there was only 5,000 in the vicinity. But by 1914, 90,000 had returned. And then the Balfour Declaration in 1970, when Allenby, who was a Jew, conquered the city of Jerusalem from the Turks, went in on November the 2nd, 1917, declared, "The Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." And then the great problems began. In 1920, they had what they called the endorsement of the San Remo. And at that time, 300,000 Jews now had returned, were on their way back to Jerusalem and to Palestine. But this young man who had heard about the return of the Jews and said that he'd believe it when he saw it, happened to be in Jerusalem in 1920. And he was one block away when the San Remo situation occurred, which was the instrument of British international policy allowing the Jews to immigrate. And there was a riot, and a number of Arabs attacked the Jews in the vicinity. He was to realize the Jews were back, and it wasn't going to be anything but intervene on their behalf. And he was within a block of where the circumstantial situation of that riot occurred. And that man was David O. McKay. Then in 1935 came the bitter resistance of the Arabs, and you know what happened up until 1939 when the White Paper was initiated. And then on November the 29th, 1947, a man by the name of Dr. Sukinik walked across the area to the barbed wire separating the land of Jerusalem from the Arabs. There was no man's land, and he looked across the barbed wire, and he was the first to see the Dead Sea Scrolls and know their validity. When he looked through the barbed wire, he was filled with consternation. He wanted to see them and feel them and study them and learn them. It was November the 23rd, really. And by November the 29th, he had smuggled himself across barbed wire into Bethlehem, picked up the three documents that he saw, and back again, he was home. Wouldn't the Arabs like to have had him? His son was head of the Haganah, the chief of staff of the Israeli armies. And I suppose when his son found out, things must have really went through the ceiling. Because on November the 29th, when he realized the antiquity of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the United Nations declared Israel a state for the first time in 1920 years. All through the headlines and everything, of course. And of course, they went to war. By April, the armistice and the British mandate had been totally removed, and the Israelis were attacked by the Arabs. They fought from November to May, and then on into the time of the armistice. And as you know, this was the great battle which occurred where they were totally out. They were just outdone in every area. And yet there was intervention. It was time for their restoration. And they were restored except for the city of Jerusalem and the temple site. Dr. Sukinik, in his diaries, which I have some, and his son, the Jewish general, was Yagididin. Yagididin later was to join his father, because Yagididin was also an archaeologist. And even though he was a Jewish general, he was to occupy himself with archaeology for a number of years, and then finally he is totally occupied now, as younger men have taken over the military positions. Four other scrolls had been found, and they had been sold to a man by the name of Athanasius Samuel during this same winter. And they were later brought to the United States. And Yagididin and his father intervened and got a person in New York to purchase those first four scrolls that came here to the United States for $250,000. And Dr. Gossman gave them as a gift back to Israel. And then, with Sukinik having three books, now seven great volumes of the Dead Sea Scrolls were put into a museum built after the shape of one of the jars in which they were found, the lid. And that's where I've studied some of the documents and where other men go to study them. And since then, many other caves were found and all the marvelous documents. But Yagididin had some significant circumstances where the Mormons are concerned. In 1962-64, he was responsible for the excavation of Masada, where they also found a number of ruins associated with the Qumran people, who had gone there for refuge and were the last zealots holding out against General Sylvia of the 10th Roman Legion of Titus, of the Roman armies. And the scrolls were found there are those that are parallel to the Dead Sea Scrolls, found up the Dead Sea a little further up on the northern end. And also in another cave, he was able to find a bundle of material, dispatches, 15 of them, I think, or maybe there was 18. And in one of the dispatches, a most exciting thing was to occur. Three little events which were to touch the hearts of millions, and maybe you've never heard of them because the years have gone by. But he was to flash that month on a screen one of the documents, and he was to show it to Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister in all these years. And here he showed Ben-Gurion the signature of the last prime minister of Israel before he had been killed by the Romans. And then he showed them the signature of the last Jewish general before he was killed by the Romans, and the documents had been found by the first chief of staff 1,900 years in the Israeli armies. And one of the other documents, he translated a rather interesting name. On page 177 of a book of his, this name is rather interesting because it is a name that's been involved in an actual polemic against the church, where we have been accused of believing in the naivety of a youthful Joseph Smith who would have used a female name for a Mormon prophet called Alma. Everybody knows that Alma Mater means fostering mother, and yet Joseph Smith said that Alma was a man's name. And in the text found by Yagididin, one of the individuals who gave a deed to the Jewish general back 1,900 years ago was Alma, the son of Judah. And he translates it sensibly, Alma, in his book, confirming the Book of Mormon name. But then a great discovery had been made at the turn of the century. Have any of you ever heard of the Elephantine Archives? Some of you have, because you've probably been reading some of Nibley's books, and that's excellent if you have. In the book, Sense Cumorah, Nibley points out that the Elephantine Archives are the most important single commentary to the Book of Mormon found any place. They were found nearly 70 years ago, then they were put in the trunk and lost for 50 years. They were found in the Bronx just recently and have now been translated. I gave this book to my son, The Archives from Elephantine, which deals with a Jewish colony in Egypt 600 years before Christ. Where did Lehi traffic as a merchant when he was in Palestine? Was there a Jewish colony to which he made contact with and communicated with? Why did he absorb so much Egyptian material? And why was he so much involved in terms of using Egyptian names for his sons? Here in this particular book, I gave this to my son as a Christmas present, and he hasn't seen it since. Well, he did one day. We spent on beginning of pages about 118, clear through here, are pages after pages of the names found in the archives of Elephantine. Names like Abishar and Badadiah, but double A's and double M's. And all through the Book of Mormon, we have such names as Kib and Kibadiah. And you see these names that are now in the Book of Mormon, many of them are in the archives of Elephantine. Joseph Smith did not dream them up. They were authentic names of a Jewish colony and Egyptians in Egypt 600 years before Christ, the very same time the Book of Mormon was supposed to have represented to have been prepared by Lehi. Well, you can get that book, and you can follow through on it. And they had a temple, and the name of the temple there is the same name we call it today, the House of the Lord. And the ordinances they must have experienced there were very similar to what we have today in the ancient temple at Jerusalem before it was distorted. Some other things are going on, too. We go back to Yagididin, because something else happened in 1967. During the Six-Day War, Another scroll was offered for sale by a man called Kondo, who I now know personally, and he wanted $1.5 million for this scroll. Yagilyadin didn't want to pay him $1.5 million, but during the Six-Day War, Kondo was put under house arrest and shipped off to Tel Aviv. And after the Six-Day War, the general had the scroll, and Kondo had his freedom. Kondo wouldn't say what he got paid for, and the general wouldn't say what he paid for. The whole story has never been written, and there's probably three reasons. Again, you hear me saying three reasons all the time. Yagilyadin knows that there's maybe seven other scrolls involved. And this scroll that he got from Kondo had hid it under the floor, or someone had, and they finally were able to find it and get it. But they made some kind of an agreement. Probably other scrolls were involved. But when 4 days later, Yagilyadin went to translate the scroll and work on it, it is the longest of all the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's nearly 33 feet long, about 29 feet of inscribed surface. The most beautiful and one of the best. And it's the only one of all the scrolls that is in the first vernacular with the Lord speaking command. Build a temple in a place called New Jerusalem. Yagilyadin was in the United States here last spring. He now understands the Mormons are looking forward to that book with a great deal of apprehension and interest, because it describes the temple to be built in a place called New Jerusalem, and it describes a temple that will have a high wall and 12 gates named after the 12 tribes of Israel, and an inner court, three inner courts. He described the temple that Joseph Smith had revealed to him more than 130 years ago to be built in a place called New Jerusalem. But there's more. 4 days after Yagilyadin got the scroll and went to, and I have his personal account, and I got that in Israel about 3 years ago, he unrolled the scroll. Just as they had deployed the troops in the Six-Day War, the first part of that scroll dealt with the deployment of troops as they had just got through deploying their troops. And the censors would not let him translate for 7 years. Now it should appear this spring in English. I think it appeared in Hebrew in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem this winter. I'm waiting to find out. And then we'll be able to make a lot of comparisons. Now, the temple to be built in Old Jerusalem is described in Ezekiel, the 40th to the 43rd chapter, given to Ezekiel in a great revelation. And the temple to be built in New Jerusalem was given to Joseph Smith in a revelation. And if you want to have details, you can get a book by Dyer called Refiner's Fire. It has much of the information therein. The temple scroll is very exciting because there's a whole corpus of material in the Dead Sea Scrolls that talk about New Jerusalem. Where is it? He now knows the Mormons know more about it than they do over there. And he realizes that there's rather a great deal of excitement attached to that scroll being made available here in the near future. He came over to lecture on Masada. And they found out everybody here wanted to learn about the temple scroll. So he gave them a little session that's been taped, and it's rather interesting. And one of the great doctrines of the Dead Sea Scrolls has to do with Moses. In the Book of Mormon, it says Moses was translated, and that he was translated. And we understand the doctrine of translation, probably the only church that ever has details, and the whole book was published on the doctrine of translation by one of the members of the church here last month. And so you can probably get it. It's called Those Who Tarry. But the doctrine that Moses was translated has been unique in our teachings. 140 years we've opposed all Christian denominations and all Old Testament teachers that said that he was buried on Mount Ebal by the Lord. And one of the scrolls, I don't know whether I can find the book now, we got so many up here, deals with the assumption of Moses, and a book dealing with other sources of the material have these three things to say concerning Moses. Accordingly, he designed and devised me, Moses, and he prepared me before the foundation of the world that I should be the mediator of his covenant. And the translator says, the claim of Moses' preexistence, of his being created before the world, is, as far as I know, to be found nowhere else. The doctrine of preexistence again materializes here. Foreordination of prophets like Moses is described, and his function to be the mediator of the covenant of God is here in this ancient text. As a prophet, the Testament of Moses shares many traits of his biblical predecessors, and it even points out that his intercessory role did not end with his natural life. And the special qualifications of a prophet like Moses is to have known God face to face. And then the last part of this book deals with the translation of Moses. As he goes upon the mountain, he weeps, and the people are weeping as they follow him. And then pretty soon the adversary appears as an angel of light, which is in the Book of Mormon as a doctrine. And then Michael appears to detect him in the 128th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. That profound doctrine is taught. And then with the adversary being detected and thwarted in his plans, Moses ascends the mountain, angels appear, he becomes translucent, the Lord appears, and he's carried into heaven as a translated being. Where did Joseph Smith get his information? Then over here in the 46th chapter of Mosiah, here's a story. Yet let us preserve our liberty as a remnant of Joseph. And here in the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith has inserted a tale here that Jacob, before his death, saw that a part of the remnant of the coat of Joseph was preserved and had not decayed. And it's found also in 3 Nephi in the 10th chapter. And that a remnant of the seed of Joseph would be preserved like a remnant of the garment. And that garment story is not found in anything that we know of except an Arab by the name of Talibi, who wrote in the 10th century. In 1975, on my way to BYU to give a lecture, I received a book by McLurian, and I was studying it on the way up. And these other things now have materialized. Some that Nibley referred to a long time ago in 1957, and then this material by McLurian. And there, this torn garment tale, which goes back to Talibi, was collected in Persia a long time ago. But it refers to fascinating things. In the garment of Joseph, there were three marks. Now, in our garments today, we have four, but two are the same kind. Now, where did they get the doctrine of marks in a garment? And Joseph gave them the garment, and it was the very one that had belonged to Abraham, already having had a long history since this ancient document, the Adak. Now, Dr. McLaren, he points out that in his study of the garment of Joseph, he says it was an ankle-length garment with long sleeves. It played a big part in Joseph's subsequent fate. In fact, he points out that Joseph publicly attributed his power of divination to his relationship with Elohim. And there may even be a suggestion that Elohim had given Joseph the power to transmit the gift of prophecy to others after he'd received the garment. The garment is described here as composed of a part of the garment composed of a pointed hat. And there was a robe associated with pleats. Any parallels to anything you know anything about? He goes on here and says that this represented a magical garment, and it's probably relevant to recall that according to the biblical account, Joseph's great-grandfather, himself reputed to be a competent astronomer, had in fact come from the city of Ur, where they have found images and idols and little things describing the same kind of a garment on these images. And this person here says, did Jacob get the pattern of the garment of Joseph from his grandfather Abraham? And I read to you that other document last session, where Abraham got his garment from Melchizedek. It was patterned after the garment made by God for Adam and Eve. We don't have time to pursue that any further, but you can see what's coming out now that only LDS people can understand. Now let's go to a little different one. Here's a new book called The Day Spring. In a few moments we have left. This is the story of an unknown apostle to the Americas by Arlo Miller. He knows about the Mormons. He doesn't want to hear a thing about them because he's very disturbed that we're using his book this way. And he knows we're using this book because one of his people who lived right next door to him was in my class last week. And I was using it. He points out here that there was a legend in Central America, particularly in Mexico, and this legend has to do with a god who is white and bearded. He came from the east, from across the ocean. He was a fugitive from his own land. He came a very long time ago. And he taught a gentle faith and was opposed to human or animal sacrifice. Now here's what he goes on to say. Following the initial revelation, when Quetzalcoatl came here, all religions depend for popular support on ritual and liturgical practices which crystallize the essential elements of faith. Now, in Christianity, the essential elements are purification of the body by baptism, purification of the soul by confession and absolution, propitiation and prayers to the deity, sacrifices by proxy, the sacrament, the identification of the worshiper with God by his own sacrifice, the offering of goods or services, and the reward, life after death, the resurrection. Now, these are all his words, Arnold Miller's. He says, all of these liturgical practices were found by the 16th century Spanish priests in the New World when they arrived. All were associated with the name of the American cultural hero, Quetzalcoatl, or his successors in the high priesthood. Then he goes back and traces this whole thing. His conclusion in his book is that an apostle of the Lord, Jesus Christ, came here in the first century and taught all the Christian doctrines here. But if you read the Book of Mormon, he'd have the details. You'd know that it was Christ himself. He even goes on and says such things as this. By 300 B.C., the people we know as Zapotecs who lived on the Pacific coast in the narrow neck, notice this use, were making astronomical observations based on the old Olmec system. And then he goes on and points out that it now becomes quite clear that some event of major historical importance did in fact occur in pre-Columbian America, which led to a widespread revolution in religion and ethics, and that the beginning of this process may be dated with a good degree of accuracy to a little earlier than the first half of the second century after the birth of Christ. And that's when it did all begin. In another place here he says, there was a practice of baptism, but it was not given to infants, only adults. And you all know the parallel there. In fact, he says, Dalanda also traces a sacred communion-like meal to the Mayan areas in Yucatan. So these books are again bringing us right up to the fact that somehow or another, in the winding up scene, the world, constraint of evidence, is going to tell the world that the gospel is true. 100 years ago, President Brigham Young stated that in the last days, the constraint of evidence will demonstrate to the world that the church is absolutely true, and the only thing we're going to have to do is prove authority. And like the Baha'i faith and other individuals who claim all of these things, I can ask one question that stops them cold in their track. Where the Nag Hammadi is concerned, the Dead Sea Scrolls are concerned, or any of the other great discoveries are concerned, or even this. What is the new name, and where do you get it? And any good elder can tell you. In the name of Christ, amen.